With us is Professor Shara Vostrel, Assistant Professor in Science, Technology, and Studies Department at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. And we've had Shara on before on this show talking about menstruation and menstrual technologies. And in fact, she has done a considerable amount of research on gender history and the history of sexuality. And she's finishing up a book titled Under Wraps, a new title for it, The History of Menstrual Hygiene. But today we're not going to be talking about that topic, are we?
No.
We're going to be talking about Julia Dent Grant, the wife of Ulysses S. Grant, and their family life during the Civil War and perhaps a little bit before and after. But we're going to be looking at the role of this woman and other women, perhaps, during the Civil War on the home front in support of the Union, but also the powerful role that women had during war and during the Civil War specifically. But Shara, I'd like to start off today by asking you how you got interested in Julia Dent Grant and in Grant and in everything related to
them. Yes, that's a very good question. Well, when I was in graduate school, I had a sort of permanent part-time job at the National Park Service. And what I did was study Ulysses S. Grant at a new site that was being created in St. Louis for the memory of Ulysses S. Grant. It was the Ulysses S. Grant National Historic Site. And part of the history program that I was in was very devoted to regional history and learning about St. Louis history. And so it just made sense for me to work there over the summers and do research. And as I learned more about Grant, the things that became more intriguing to me were not necessarily his battlefield successes or his heroism, but actually his wife and the children and the slaves that lived and worked together at Whitehaven. So that's sort of where my interest in the family and Grant stemmed from.
And we'll explore some of the ironies of the wife or the family of Grant, the head of the Union troops during the Civil War, at the same time slaveholders.
Yeah. And Grant became involved with the Dent family because when he was at West Point, he met Julia's brother, Fred. And so they were stationed at Jefferson Barracks, which was very close to St. Louis. And so he would come almost every week for dinners to their home in St. Louis.
This was in the 1840s.
Yes.
When they were courting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so Julia was off. She would be off in St. Louis or other places. And finally, one weekend, she came home and Ulysses was there. And after that, he visited every day, and they would go off on these rides throughout their her father's plantation, pretty much. And so their romance and their courtship started very, very early on in the 1840s. So Grant, per se, was not a slaveholder when he met Julia, but obviously when he married her, he became part of that family and part of that system. And I should say that Julia's father was fairly well received in St. Louis. He owned over 1,000 acres in St. Louis, which they farmed. They farmed all sorts of different things. They farmed wheat and corn. They had orchards of peaches and apples. They had vineyards. So it was a quite extensive place. And Julia talks about fishing while she was a youngster. So it was very expansive. It took a lot of work, obviously, and they owned about 8 to 10 slaves on and off.
What was Grant's background, his class background?
Well, it was that much below Julia's. He grew up, and he was, you know, cobbling with his father. His father was, he wasn't poor, but, you know, he was definitely kind of a working class kind of guy. And so the military did sort of provide a way out and also a means of status for him as well. And it provided a great source of his identity, too. Although, even when he was away, like during the Mexican War, they had just gotten engaged, and he just was so forlorn, really, without Julia. And he'd write these just heart-wrenching letters to her about his melancholy and how sad he was and how he didn't think he could feel more alone than he did at that moment. So this this idea of separation and the importance of her being near him started very early on for them.
Well, the conventional view of her role in his life was that she helped to keep him sober, in quotes.
Right.
But you've taken a different view. And I should mention that you've written an article on their relationship, actually several, but the one I'm most familiar with is called The Movable Home, Julia Dent Grant and the Movable Homefront, Maintenance of a General's Family, in which you actually take to task those who simply see her as someone who kept the general sober.
Right.
You look at some of the more complex roles that she played during the war.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you can read it sort of simplistically and say, well, you know, when she did show up, it seemed like he stopped drinking. And there are certainly lots of accounts where people are trying to get him to stop drinking, or, you know, people are reporting to Lincoln, you know, what can he do? He's on a binge again. So, you know, there's been a lot of effort to try to say he wasn't a drunkard, or, you know, he didn't have a drinking problem. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, he drank. He did drink. I don't think we can kind of skirt that issue. Whether he was an alcoholic, I think that's, you know, a debatable medical term that wasn't around at the time, so they weren't calling him that then. Certainly he was functional. I mean, he did pretty much succeed in winning the military victory, but that doesn't mean he didn't find drink as, you know, helping with his solace or whatever. So, you know, I think it was a real thing. But I think Julia, it wasn't just that when she showed up that he stopped drinking, but Julia managed, I mean, that just simplifies her relationship to him and all the different things she did. Because when they got married, and as her father became more infirm and ill, the Grants really took on this farming project of managing the slaves. I mean, he had three different properties and houses that they cared for. There were tenants. And then during the war, obviously, many of the slaves left. They were hiring out slaves. I mean, it was this very complicated business transactions that were happening. And so he would send very detailed letters to her saying, you know, you got to get the renter's money and pay back my brother, or you got to go and pay this off and take it to city court. I mean, so she was really sort of like a legal aide or assistant in some ways to his letters.
Right. Before we get into her role during the war, I'm curious as to how he so quickly obtained these promotions, because he was almost a nobody in the 1860-1861. He had dropped out of the military in 54, I think it was.
Yeah.
Somewhere around there, because he was being moved
miserable.
Around. He was being moved around and separated from his wife and kids, and he couldn't stand it.
And I think the last straw for him was his son being born, and it was like 3 or 6 months later before he even saw the kid. And so he really just, it made him feel horrible. And I think, you know, it wasn't clear that the military was his thing. He even got, when he was trying to ask for Julia's hand in marriage, he asked her father and said that he might have an opportunity to become a mathematics professor. And so that was supposedly going to be a more secure job. And so that seemed to appease her father a little bit. So, you know, they had the farm. He took a try at farming to some degree of success. I know he's been sort of characterized as being a failure in all sorts of different business ventures, and in many ways he was, although I remember looking at some of the yields that he got from the wheat and corn crops, which were extraordinary considering sort of the rain and the hail and all the problems that they would have. So farming was very difficult. I think it still continues to be. So I think it wasn't necessarily him per se, but just that there's a question about that in general.
In the late 50s, he was mostly concentrated on farming. I know that between the time they were married in 1848, you write that he had moved to Detroit, Michigan, then Sackett's Harbor, New York, and then Columbia, Fort Vancouver.
Right.
And then finally, he had enough of it in 1854. So at that point, he drops out of the military, and then he takes up farming?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And he builds a house called Hardscrabble, which is this really sort of rough-hewn log cabin sort of thing that ends up going on tour, like for the 1904 World's Fair, and now it's part of Anheuser-Busch, the farm there. And Julia hated it. I mean, she was very, you know, being brought up with a mammy that she called mammy. She wasn't really taught how to cook very well. She talks about how all she could really make was, like, cake and jelly. I mean, she's just really not particularly functional in the kitchen or any of this sort of thing. So Hardscrabble was really kind of the joke name, but also very depressing for her to live at this place.
Uh-huh. Now, how is he pulled back into the military, and when is he pulled back in?
He becomes part of the Illinois Volunteer Regiment. And I think when the war breaks out, there's just no sort of question that he does have to go back. I mean, as a West Point-trained grad, it's just not a question.
Mm-hmm. Now, why Illinois? Were they living there?
Where were they at the time? You know, I don't remember.
Yeah. So this one, but I mean, they were all over the place. I can see why you don't remember.
No, they're in Galena. They're in Galena.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so he's that. And 61, his position is, he comes in as a colonel?
Yeah. And then just within a short, I think 2 years, he's a major general. And then by 64, he's general. Command of all the troops.
Just incredible. I guess there was a shortage of talent.
Yeah, well, there's a shortage. Yeah. People are making just really stupid kind of mistakes, and he seems to be fighting. I mean, that was what Lincoln always said about him. You know, he fights. He didn't necessarily agree with some of his tactics or what he did, but it seemed like it was working. And, I mean, he joked that even about his drinking, that he wished whatever Grant was drinking he could give to his other generals because it seemed like there was something in the whiskey that helped him do it. I don't know. So he does. He has this sort of, you know, this very fast-track career in the military, and Julia follows him, you know? I mean, she follows him around, and, you know, of course, he tells her sometimes, no, it's too dangerous or you can't go, but the idea is usually that she should try to meet him where he's fighting, which just seems entirely counterintuitive that you would want your family on the war front.
Was this typical in the Civil War that officers' wives would follow the officers?
I think more so than now. I mean, there were moments where there would be like these, I almost want to call them wives' clubs, where there'd be not only Union officers' wives, but Confederate officers' wives who would sort of be housed together in people's homes, like outside of Vicksburg or outside of Holly Springs. So it was this sort of reciprocal obligation in some ways, mm-hmm. that it was an understanding that the wives would come along, which, of course, it's sort of a gentlemanly thing that you wouldn't harm these women and sometimes children, too, in this enemy territory. But, of course, there were dangers because Julia talks about marauders coming through and, like, stealing her luggage or looking for her. And luckily, she had crossed the river to meet Grant. So there were elements of danger in doing this.
But it's interesting about this gentleman's quote. I mean, many of these generals, many of these officers had known each other
exactly.
In the military academy in West Point. So, I mean, it's now they were fighting against each other.
Right.
But they had been classmates.
They'd been classmates. I mean, they had been in Grant's groomsmen at his wedding as well. So, I mean, there's definitely an intimacy and familiarity with these guys.
And especially Julia, who came from the South.
Right.
Was, you know,
right. Yeah, Missouri is a slave state. Mm-hmm. It's still part of the Union, but certainly.
It's a border state.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but it has Southern yes. sympathies. Her father would just, he would just rant through the streets of St. Louis about his right to own slaves and, you know, how can they do this to me? So, there was tension definitely at home with Grant fighting this war against slavery and then the slaves still being at his father's place. It's just this very ironic thing that's forgotten. I mean, we just don't remember that Grant owned slaves.
Yeah. Besides bringing his wife to join him, he also brought his kids, which I found very surprising. Could you talk a little bit about that whole...
Yeah, you know, when you read these letters that he writes home, he's just so, you can't kind of help but like the guy because he really is just so tender toward his kids and he jokes with them and he talks about like Jess, his youngest son, Jesse, stalking around the office, I mean, his tent, basically, his commander's tent, and that it's just not the same without him. And I think it just brought a degree of just sanity to this crazy war, you know, and just to have the kids and their laughter and their antics, I think really just provided a sort of grounding and escape from just the brutality and wretchedness of the war. And so it was usually his sons who wanted to come to camp with him. And one of his older sons did come to camp at Virginia Point, at City Point in Virginia. And there was another instance where he was assigned one of the aides was assigned to watch his son Fred, and Fred escaped because it was just too constraining. And so he was marching along with the troops, and he was eating hardtack, and he ended up getting just slightly grazed by a bullet. But of course, this was much more exciting than going to school. And so he felt life lived as a soldier was far more interesting than, you know, being at boarding school or, you know, learning about French literature or German or anything like that. So the kids, you know, they loved it. As difficult as that is to sort of think about children being on the war front, Julia thought it was an education as well. I mean, she compared it to an education of Alexander the Great. I mean, this was like a classic education in her rationalization for why the boys should be along this war front.
Now, obviously, I think what you wrote about it as though she was apologizing or explaining, because she was sort of projecting that her readers would expect, this is in her memoirs,
right.
Her readers would expect some kind of explanation because it would be unusual. Why are you sending your children out there, even to Vicksburg? I mean, Fred was near.
Right.
So she had an explanation, and so did the So did Grant. I mean, Ulysses, he said, "My son accompanied me throughout the campaign and siege and caused no anxiety either to me or to his mother, who was at home. He looked out for himself and was in every battle of the campaign. His age then, not quite 13, enabled him to take in all he saw and to retain a recollection of it that would not be possible in more mature years."
And this just sounds crazy, doesn't it?
I can imagine, you know, our soldiers bringing their kids over to Iraq today.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly different kinds of wars.
Different kinds of wars,
but,
yes.
you know, I guess as a teenager, how could it not be exciting to go out to the front that way? And, you know, I guess in retrospect, you know, schooling is not standardized at this point. Clearly, you know, public education is not organized like we understand it today. So education was a very sort of private thing. And if being a soldier is part of the learning experience, that's what they could provide at that point. Mm. So
there was one incident about an attempt to kidnap Fred, I believe,
yes,
in Caseyville, near Caseyville, when Julia was visiting her sister, Emma Dent Casey, there.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about that event and what impact it had on them?
He was visiting his aunt, and there were some marauders, some sort of, they were Confederate men who had been basically stalking him in a lot of ways, and her sister realized that he was in danger, and so she put him on a barge and sent him, you know, back, well, up or down the river, I can't remember, I think this was in Cairo, Illinois, to get back home, and went just in the nick of time, pretty much, because the guys came back and asked, you know, "Where's Fred? We know he's here." And they were going to ransom him. And, of course, a general's son could be a very prized possession in terms of ransom and leverage. So, you know, I think they were a little bit flippant about the danger, the true dangers that they were putting their children in some ways.
Yeah, it strikes me as that being the case, too. During the war, you alluded to this earlier, Julia had to really take charge of a lot of the business of the plantation.
Yes.
And this was something that I know historians have written about, the Revolutionary War, how women came in and basically took over the running of these farms.
Right.
And here again, during the Civil War, when the men went away to war, the women stepped in. And it happens in every war in American history.
Right.
How did she do?
Yeah, in the Revolutionary War, they called them deputy wives because they were sort of granted a sort of temporary pass, I guess, at doing these sorts of things. I mean, I think she did okay. I don't know. I don't think she was particularly good at strong-arming the tenants to get the money out of them. I don't think she was particularly tough in that way. She didn't like it. I mean, I think that's the thing. She didn't like it. She didn't like going and doing the dirty work. There was one point where she was looking for a house in Philadelphia, and she was so relieved that the men, you know, these men's clubs, gave her husband a home so that she didn't have to worry about the contracts and the signing and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think she did what she could, and she tried to be Grant's mouthpiece the best way that she could. But she really felt that her, you know, sole purpose was to raise the children and provide Grant sort of relief in this way by providing a family that he could rely on and a family that really loved him. So, you know, she is sort of doing the dirty work, but I would say in the most in the way that she can do it without sort of totally disappointing him. I mean, it's not her choice in a lot of ways.
You alluded to the difficulty she had. I remember you were writing about one tenant, White, I think his name
Joseph
was?
White.
Joseph White, yeah. That would not pay the rent.
Yeah, he wouldn't pay the rent. And then they finally do get the rent out of him, but he's just been such a bad tenant. And then he goes out to Montana, and he wants Grant to write him a letter of, like, recommendation, saying, yes, he'll be a good business person at this outpost out in Montana. And they're just horrified at this guy being pretty much, you know, unscrupulous and not paying, that he would go out and just start all over again out there. So they're not too interested in that.
Just to exemplify some of the difficulties
that she
faced during the war. But she was also, besides managing property and managing the holdings, she was also an informal diplomat, was she not, during the Civil War?
Yeah.
You write a little bit about that.
Yeah, because she is a Southern-born woman and raised as a Southerner, she does have these connections to other Southern women who are married then to other Southern generals. And so, you know, there was some discussion by Longstreet that Julia...
It's James Longstreet,
James
Longstreet, Confederate general.
That maybe his wife and Julia should sort of negotiate some of the terms of surrender at the end of the war. Since they were friends, they could both take these sort of, 10 or 12 other... soldiers with them, and you know, they would sort of begin these terms of discussion, which, you know, she just thought was a great idea. That this didn't come to fruition, but she just had these really grand ideas that this would be a good thing. But you know, she does do some very smart things. You know, she invites Lincoln to come down to some of the battlefield sites. Grant's not too keen on this idea, but you know, it's smart. It's a very smart thing to have the commander in chief come down, check out how things are going, and just be on good terms with him. So, you know, she does do those sorts of things.
What was the relationship between the Grants and Lincoln?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly between Grant and Lincoln, it was very cordial. Mm-hmm. They were very respectful of each other. They, you know, Lincoln obviously provided a lot of support, finances, you know, whatever Grant needed, Grant was able to get fairly easily, and he respected Grant because Grant actually fought. I think Julia and Mary Todd Lincoln have a much more strained relationship. I don't think that's unusual to say about Mary Todd, just because she did have so many quirks. So I think Julia did try to sort of extend a hand out to Mary Todd Lincoln, but even, you know, the sort of the fated day that Lincoln was assassinated, Grant and Julia and Ulysses were supposed to be at Ford's Theater. They were the intended invitees to the play, and they declined. And some biographers have said that they declined on the flimsiest of excuses, which was that Grant wanted to see the children. And perhaps that was an excuse, but I tend to believe he really did want to see the children. I think, you know, with the end of the war and sort of the craziness of all the things afterwards, his kids were away at school and he hadn't seen them. And he really, I really do believe that was one of his priorities, was to maintain those contacts with him. So
it certainly strikes me as being one from at least the quotations that you have from letters between the two of them. By the way, we should talk a little bit about the sources. You used memoirs, you used the correspondence.
So Grant obviously wrote his memoirs. There's letters. I mean, I don't even know how many volumes the set is anymore that John Y. Simon has edited. Julia wrote her own memoirs. And then, you know, there's photographs, and there's a lot of information that the National Park site has itself. And especially in terms of some of the slave-related items, there's some really wonderful archaeological finds that went on at that site as well.
That's a good transition to the final topic for us to talk about, which is the slavery, which is at the core of the Civil War. And here it is, the tensions, the ironies.
Yeah.
In this relationship between a northerner and a southern, in a quote, middle state southerner, aristocrat. She's an aristocrat.
Right.
And yet, you know, she's pulled a bit, women in the South saying, oh, you're a southerner.
Right.
And she said at one point, you quote her saying, I am from the West.
Yeah. That's why Missouri is so interesting, because it is sort of the Western frontier, but it's, you know, it's the West, it's the South, it's partly the North. So it's this strange sort of mix of sentiments and feelings. And so, yeah, by saying she's from the West, she can sidestep all those stereotypes and labels, although she is very much a sort of Southern kind of person. Because, you know, they owned slaves. There's no way around it. I mean, there's documents where Grant was trying to hire out some of his slaves, William Jones. He would send him to St. Louis to be outsourced, pretty much, and bring back money that he made from working downtown. But there was, her mammy, the Kitty. Kitty was her name. There was her slave, Jewel, who was a nurse, who was basically like a nanny who took care of the kids that would go to the front. I mean, this is so ironic. She would take this black servant down south with her children to watch after the children while she visited Grant. I mean, the irony of this is just incredible to me, that that you could do that and that it would be accepted.
And at one point, she ran away.
Yeah,
Julia,
she did.
Jewel ran away.
Yeah.
And what happened? Did she ever come back, or was this permanent separation?
No, it was temporary. They did. Mm-hmm. She did come back. But Grant, in Grant's memoirs, he says he was relieved because, you know, obviously this doesn't look good for your wife's slave to be running away while you're fighting this war to end slavery.
So did they free the slaves before they had to?
Yes, they did. They did, sort of halfway through the war. And then they used immigrant laborers to help with the farm. But, you know, the slave life was pretty, the slave life was very rich there. I mean, and the archaeological work that was done at the site revealed what they called was the best set of slave-related material artifacts in the state of Missouri after the dig was over. And, you know, a lot of it was in the kitchen, which you can imagine because that's where people were working. But a lot of marbles, you know, where kids were playing underneath, both white and black children would have been playing in the kitchen. Plates that had been broken that would have been lifted, the boards in the kitchen lifted up and the plates snuck underneath after they broke. But also slate to learn how to write and slate pencils. So they were learning how to read, which was an illegal activity as well. So there's the site is very interesting in that way to represent slavery and also this very interesting dimension of the relationship between Julia and Ulysses that relied on slavery. And I guess I should say as well that since he did come from this slave, he married into the slave family, I think it provided him a sort of unique insight into Reconstruction and into the terms of surrender, especially with Lee, and that he is not brutal, especially. He lets them keep their horses. He lets them keep firearms in some ways. So I think he has a sort of sympathy in some ways to get the nation back on its feet that wasn't as harsh as some other Republicans would have wanted at the time.
And yet in 1872, he aligns himself with the radical Republicans.
Yeah, it's messy.
It's very messy.
But I think that's the really wonderful thing about it, that this example just shows that nothing is cut and dry in history, and you do have to sort of peel it back a little bit.
Well, it's certainly complex and a fascinating, fascinating story. And Shara, I want to thank you very much
for
coming
having me
to Talking History. Shara Vostrel here at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, an assistant professor of science technology studies and an expert on Ulysses S. Grant and Julia Dent Grant. Thank you very much.
You're
and
welcome.
We'll have to have you here again.